night. And I'm so proud of my home group for the representation that we had here last night. None of them are here this morning, but they were about 12 of us were here last night, and I'm really, really happy about that. I hear a lot in AA that people say that they got here because they drank too much. And my story is I got here because I drank just enough. And I earned my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm proud to be a member. I have a feeling that our speaker has earned her seat in Alcoholics Anonymous and that she probably drank just enough to get her here too. I will say, I don't know what you guys did last night, but I spent all night long trying to pronounce Chilliwack, which is the city from that Lou and Linda live in British Columbia. Let's everybody welcome our speaker all the way from British Columbia, Linda from Chilliwack.
Thank you. My name is Linda Finnemore, and I am an alcoholic. Amen. And it's only by God's grace and this fellowship that I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since November 7th, 1979. Sometimes I get really emotional when I think about the last 22 years and what my life was like and what happened and what it's like today, and I have so much gratitude around that. You know, this morning we were over at the Waffle House having breakfast, and there was a little girl there serving us, and Buddy asked me, "Are you nervous?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And the waitress says, "Are you doing a presentation today?" And I said, "Yes." And she says, "Well, don't be nervous. Get up there and be a champ." And then she says, "What are you speaking? What are you doing your presentation on?" And Buddy, thank God, I went blank. I couldn't think what to say. He says, "On living life." And she says, "Be nervous. Be nervous." So I thought that was kind of a fitting way to start the day, because when I get up to speak, you know, it kind of, there's a little bit of deja vu involved, because my mouth gets so dry and it reminds me of the mornings after when I had to have a drink in the morning just to get over the dry mouth and the jitters and everything that went along with the drinking. First of all, I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me and Lou to come down to this beautiful part of the United States to speak. And I don't do a lot of this, but whenever I'm asked, I like to share my experience, strength, and hope with the people who have the common problem that are in the program. And first off, I want to thank Dick and Barbara for Dick picked us up at the plane on Thursday and drove us all over Atlanta, showing us the highlights of the city. And then we went home, and Barbara was home from work, and we went out and had a dinner and at the barbecue, and it was far too much. I couldn't eat half of what I ordered. I guess you call that gluttony. I don't know, when you order too much and then you don't have the capacity to eat it. But I really want to thank you, Dick and Barbara, for your kindness and for being such wonderful hosts that you've been, and to Carol and Joe. For the time that you have spent with us. It's time that I'll always value in my heart. I always write down a few things on a piece of paper because of an accident I had a few years ago. I don't retain a lot of short-term memory things and some long-term memory. And so I always put a few words on paper because I don't want to get up here and start speaking and then go blank. It could still happen, but I hope not. Also, there's one other couple that I would absolutely be remiss in not mentioning, and that I get so emotional because our friends Buddy and Nancy Lee flew down from New Jersey just to see us while we were here visiting in the States, and I'm so grateful that we have their friendship and that they took the time out of their weekend and came down to spend some time with us. It's a friendship like many, many others that we've made in Alcoholics Anonymous that we really value. You know, when I was a a young girl, the people that I hung out with all thought that I was kind of a wet blanket because I didn't drink and I didn't smoke and I didn't play around with the boys and all this kind of stuff. And little did they know that a few years later, I'd be the one with the wet brain, too. But anyhow, I grew up in a small coal mining community in southern Alberta. And we were in a family that was extremely poor. And my daddy was a coal miner. And I remember when Loretta Lynn came out with that song, Coal Miner's Daughter, you know, I thought, oh, God, they've written that song just for me, because I saw her movie, and my life and her life growing up were so much the same. And I'm grateful today that I grew up with that kind of a background, because my mom and dad taught all of us children the most important things in life, the things of understanding and caring and love, and they taught us good morals and just spent so much time loving us. And you know, although there were times when we didn't have food on the table, all we had was the bread that Mom baked that day. And the municipality would supply cases of canned meat, which was spork. You've probably heard of it. And my mother could cook that like a million different ways. We never knew that we were eating the same thing day after day after day. The winters weren't quite so bad because the coal was being sold, and there was a lot of work for the miners. But in the summer months, there was no work, and there was no unemployment, there was no welfare, there was just people trying to make ends meet. And of course, I didn't know there was anything better, because everybody in the community, the coal mining community, lived the same way. And I have two sisters and four brothers. And we grew up all loving and caring for each other, and that love and caring is still there today. We all get along so well, and you know, the wonderful thing is that from the beginnings that we all had, we've all made our way in life very well, and I thank God for that every day too. I remember when the first time I ever sat on a flush toilet, I was 16 years old, and I thought, gee, that was a glorious feeling for this little old butt, not so little today, but it's still there. it was wonderful to be able to get in a shower instead of bathing in the middle of the kitchen floor in a bathtub that started with the oldest and then worked down to the youngest. And by the time the youngest got in there for their bath, there'd be a gallon of hot water added for each person that got in, just so the water wasn't too cold for the last one. And there was a friend of my dad's that would, you know, he made a point. He knew Sunday night was bath night at our house, and he would come over on Sundays. And my dad had to build a little curtain with a sheet around it, because he knew right about the time that we were going to get in the tub that this fellow was going to show up at the door, you know. And surprise to him, one night he got there and the curtain was hung and he didn't come back anymore on Sunday nights. But when I first started work, when I was at the age of 16, I got my very first job, and I moved into the big city of Trochu, which was about 350 people at that time, and I went to work at the hospital, and I had such a glorious job. I was doing the laundry for all the patients and for the sisters that ran the hospital, but it was wonderful for me, because it was the first time in my life that I ever had a little bit of money of my own to spend. And I remember my very first paycheck, I took it home, I took it to the bank, cashed it, and I bought food, a roast, and some things that I knew my family hadn't had. And I went home, and my mother cooked us the most fabulous meal. And they gave me hell for spending my paycheck on food to take home and treat them. But it was the least I could do after all they had done for me growing up. You know, one of the highlights of my week when I was growing up was My father was the person that had the blasting papers to do all the dynamite work down in the coal mines. And if all my work was done and my homework was done and everything, on Saturday mornings, he'd take me down in the mines with him, and he'd drill the holes, and he'd let me put the dynamite sticks in. And it was my special time with my dad. And, you know... And he just was such a wonderful person. He had such a sense of humor and just a great, great guy. And I remember when we used to be going down, he'd put me in one of the coal cars, and then the cars were pulled by horses, by one horse, not horses. And he'd always tell me as we went by the mine shafts, we could look up, and all you'd see is a little space where you could see the light up there. And there was a ladder leading up there, and he would always tell me that if anything ever happened to him or if anything happened down there, to find my way back and to climb the stairs. And once I got to the top, I'd be safe. And, you know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was told the same thing. If you do those steps, your life's going to change and you'll be okay. And, you know, so there were a lot of things in my childhood that came back when I arrived at Alcoholics Anonymous. But anyhow, I went from working at the hospital. Well, for a while I had two jobs, one at the hospital and one at a hotel cafe waitressing. And that was where I met the man that I would marry. And I thought he was the most wonderful person in the world. I was so in love, and he was so jealous. And I thought, how lucky can I be to have someone that thinks so much of me that he doesn't want me talking to other men, and he doesn't want me going dancing, and he doesn't want to take me out. He just wants me for himself. And you know, the first few years of our marriage, there was a lot of mental abuse. And then we had two sons, and when my first son started kindergarten, I walked him to school one morning, and I went back home with my little three-year-old. And back then, of course, you didn't lock your doors when you went out, or we didn't anyhow. And I went downstairs to do a load of laundry, and there was a man there, and he raped me. And my life turned right around. My little three-year-old was upstairs, and I was afraid to holler or to fight or anything because... this man had a knife, and I was so afraid if my son came down that he would kill my son. And that was the only thing that I had on my mind. And I went upstairs after this man left. About 20 minutes later, I went upstairs and I poured myself a drink. And I drank to black out from that day until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1979. I never ever had a drink in my life that I drank to say that I could enjoy having a drink or that it was a social drink or anything like that. It was a drinking process that started. I knew when I blacked out, I would forget. And it was something that I never dealt with. I took the wrong way out. However, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my sponsor, who I loved so dearly, she told me when I went through the steps the first time, she said, Linda, there's still something that you're not talking about. And if you don't, you're not going to stay sober. And that was the first time that I ever told anybody what had happened. But my life changed so drastically that my husband didn't know what had happened to me, what was going on with me. And he started the physical beatings also. And I stayed in that marriage for two reasons. One, because he threatened me that if I ever left, that my children would be taken away from me, that he'd make sure that I didn't get custody, that I didn't have anything to do with them. And the other reason was that I was just drunk all the time. You know, I didn't have the courage or the strength or the knowledge that there is today of the places that I could have gone to get help. And so consequently, I stayed. And, you know, I don't blame him. I absolutely don't blame him for anything that happened to me, because I know today that if I had really wanted a way out. I could have found a way out. It was just the fear that I had, the lack of courage to make a move until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, in my drinking, my children would find me passed out in the bathtub, and they'd just drain the water, and my husband would come in and throw a blanket over me and leave me sleep there for the night. Or they'd find me curled up around the toilet bowl, I had to have, alcohol was hidden everywhere, in and out of the house. I think that's when I learned to love gardening, because I always had a bottle hidden in the garden, dug into the garden so that my husband wouldn't find it. And I always thought he might find the ones in the house, but he'll never look out here because he hated being around the garden. And the miracle of it all is I learned to love gardening. And that's something that I still value today because I do love gardening. And on November 6th, actually the night of November 6th, it's the last time that I ever got drunk and I just right out of it. And I got up as usual in the middle of the night to have a drink. And I went to get a drink and I went in the bathroom first and I looked in the mirror and I didn't know this person anymore that was looking back at me. And I don't know what happened. I can't tell you today. All I know is that I waited until my husband went to work in the morning and I called detox. I phoned a neighbor that I knew was in Alcoholics Anonymous and asked him if he would drive me down to the detox center. And I phoned my mother, who lived 120 miles away, and asked her if she'd come in and take care of my children. And she said, I'll be there as soon as I can. And about 2 hours later, she was at my home. My neighbor took me to detox. And I've never had to have a drink from that day to this. In detox, I was so shaky, I couldn't even hold a straw in my mouth. And then they play the cruel old trick on you. They bring you a meal, and on this plate is a bunch of peas. And they expect you to take this fork and try to pick the peas up off the plate and eat them. And, of course, that's an impossibility for a drunk that has the shakes the way that I did. But, you know, before when I came out of the detox, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, and when I walked through the doors of AA, there was a couple that were standing at the door, an older couple, and they would always say to me, Linda, you're welcome at the meeting, and they'd give me a hug. These two people were very instrumental in my sobriety because I had gone to a few AA meetings before I went to detox, but I always went there drunk. And this is when they started hugging me, and they would say, you're welcome to stay, but you're going to sit at the back of the room, and if anyone asks you to share, you're just going to say, my name's Linda, I'm an alcoholic, and I have nothing to say. And I did that each time I went into the meeting until the day that I went to the detox. And that couple were standing at the door the night I got out of detox and went to my first sober AA meeting. And they hugged me so hard. They were so happy to see me as a sober alcoholic instead of the drinking drunk that I was. And they didn't have to. They said, now you're going to come sit with us at the front of the room. John referred to something here about how in the early days, new people were just, often told to shut up or you're not allowed to share until you're sober so many months or so many weeks or whatever. I never shared at a meeting until I was about 6 months sober that I felt that I had enough self-esteem and enough courage to be able to share. And after the meeting, and I didn't talk long, only maybe a minute and a half, 2 minutes. After the meeting, an old-timer came up to me, and he says, Linda, until you have something important to say, I don't want to hear you talking at a meeting again. And I never talked again for 2 years. And that, to me, was probably the worst statement that anyone in Alcoholics Anonymous could say to someone. I hear people say things like that today, and I just cringe at it because, I feel that if a new person has the courage to say something at a meeting. It's something that's important enough to them to say, then it's important enough for us to listen to. And that's how I am in Alcoholics Anonymous today. You know, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous was the first time that I felt any hope that my life could change and that everything would get better. And I'm going to talk a little bit about sponsorship because, you know, my sponsor, if I hadn't had the sponsor that came and offered herself to me at my third meeting, I don't think I'd be here today. After she started leading me through the steps and had instructed me what I must do if I want to stay sober, and some of those things were to have a home group, to be in contact with my sponsor on a very regular basis, to get into a step meeting, and to attend Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And she led me through everything, and she was just the most wonderful person. I shouldn't say was, because she is still my sponsor today. She has been for 22 years. We live about 800 miles apart, but thank God for cheap telephone today, because we can talk on the phone whenever we wish to. And I love to sponsor girls because when they come in, I love to watch them grow. I love them. I love to see them learn to get to know God and to be able to work the steps and to start growing in the program and to become the beautiful young women that they become. And I'm a firm believer that men sponsor men and women sponsor women. And, you know, I have a lot of men friends in the program that I can talk to about a lot of things, but there's certain things that I need my female sponsor to talk with. And she, when I got to my step four and I knew that I wasn't talking about being raped, and I knew inside, I guess, too, that if I didn't talk about it, that eventually I probably would take a drink again. And she instructed me. She read me something out of the big book and told me, Linda, it's okay for you to go and seek outside help. And I know I needed that help, and I sought outside help, and I went to an abuse counselor, and I found out that I wasn't as bad a person as I had always thought that I was. And as I started working the steps and I got to know God, I started to feel a change coming about inside of me. I started feeling like the person that I had felt like as a young girl growing up. And I knew that this AA program was definitely for me. My sponsor also instructed me on how to be honest, how if I wasn't honest. And in every aspect of my life, not just cash register honesty, but if I wasn't honest with myself about everything I do on a daily basis, that, you know, my sobriety would be in jeopardy. And I knew that I never wanted to go back to be that shaky, miserable, unhappy drunk that I was when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. My dad taught me probably one of the best lessons that I could ever learn in humility. When I got to the step on humility, I started thinking back to the time when I was about 14 years old, and a family who had been great friends to our family, just before Christmas, their house burnt down, and the mother and the three daughters burnt to death in the fire. And when we were going out to the funeral the following week, I was going on to my dad about how I had nothing to wear, how was I going to go to this funeral, and why didn't we ever have decent clothing to wear instead of all rummage sale stuff and passed down clothing. And my dad just looked at me and he says, Linda, if you're going to that funeral to show people what you have to wear, you better stay home because you're going for the wrong reason. And I thought about that the minute I started thinking about humility in this program. It's not the things that we gain as we go through sobriety. It's what we get inside. And I wouldn't trade that peace and serenity that I have today. I wouldn't trade that for $1 million. It just wouldn't be worth it to me. I feel like today, I know I'm a good person. I know I treat people on a daily basis the best that I possibly can that day, and that's what I ask for in my prayers every morning. I ask God to please guide me through the day and help me to be the best person that I can be and to treat people the best way that I know how. And through doing that, I've accumulated such a variety of friends. I mean, we were at a meeting in Chilliwack one night, and they didn't hold hands at this meeting when we did the prayer at the end. And I reached over to take somebody's hand, and this fella just looked at me, and he said, "We don't hold hands here. We don't know where your hands have been." I just looked at him, and I said, "Obviously, you've never worked with a wet drunk." And the poor fella didn't know what to say. But, you know, I sat, the group that's now my home group, and I happen to believe that that group is the best group in the whole world. And I don't just say that because my sponsor told me if I didn't think my group was the best group, I better look for another one. I say it because I believe it inside today. And the people there know me, and I know them. And I attend AA with Lou because he and I are the only two in that room that know if what we're saying at a meeting is the truth or if it's not. And it's a good way to gauge your sobriety. I go to a regular Thursday afternoon ladies meeting. I never until the last 2 years ever went to just a ladies meeting because I always truly believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other. Now, I didn't stop and think that, you know, we can share it with each other, but we can also share it just amongst men or just amongst women. So anyhow, I started in Australia. I went to my first AA meeting of just women, and it was because the women in the area of Australia that we were visiting, the women do not feel comfortable in mixed meetings because of the arrogance in so many of the males. They asked me to share at a meeting one night, and when I got up there, the men started talking. They do that every time a woman was asked to share. So when this lady asked me if I'd like to go to women's meetings with her instead, the whole time that we were there for 6 weeks, I went with her to women's meetings. And I learned to love the women in those meetings and to understand that there's a reason why a lot of women don't want to go to a mixed meeting. There's a lot of women that have never attended a mixed meeting, and they have their reasons, and I don't question that. I just know that as long as they're getting sobriety, no matter where they're going, that's all that's important. In 1985, the father that I had loved so dearly died of bone cancer, and I felt like part of my heart died with him. I still miss my dad today, and that's a lot of years ago. And there isn't a day that goes by that I don't think of something that either my mother or my father said to me, either in my early years or in my years of sobriety. I remember on my 14th AA birthday was the first time my mother had ever come to an AA meeting. Lou was speaking at a conference, and I said, "You're welcome to come along because it's open for family. If you want to come, come with me." And she came, and when they did the countdown, and I got up at 14 years, and she just reached over and squeezed my hand, and I knew how much she appreciated what the people in Alcoholics Anonymous had done for me and how my life had changed because of it. My brother, who's been sober now for 17 years, came to me at just a few years of sobriety, and he says, "Linda, I want to know what you've done to change your life. I like what's happening with you." And I told him, I says, "But if you're coming here because your wife is telling you that I quit drinking or get out, your chances of making it are pretty slim. But if you're here because you want what we have to offer in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to be fine. And he never has had a drink from that day to this. And, you know, it's just some of the rewards that come along. I wish I could say the same with my two sons. I have two sons that are grown now. One will be 35 soon, and the other one will be 32 in August. And one of them's on the streets of Vancouver. And last I heard, he's smoking crack cocaine, and he's really not in very good condition. But we put him through treatment. We tried to help him every way we could. I tried to live and be the example for him, but he's not ready to accept the priceless gift of sobriety yet. And my other son, when I left to move out to British Columbia in 1990, he said to me, "If you move, I'll never speak to you again." And he stood true to his word. He does not talk to me. And it hurts, but you know what? Because of the support of the people in this program and the understanding of my sponsor and the people in my home group and Lou, I don't have to worry about that today. I know that they're in God's hands. And in God's time, if they're meant to find sobriety, they will. And if they're not, they won't. And I know that it's out of my control. And that's a very difficult thing to accept and to be able to say, you know, there's nothing I can do. I don't try to run people's lives anymore. Lou talked last night, and he was telling people about how we don't have arguments and disagreements. That's not saying we don't disagree. We just don't make an issue. He allows me to have my opinion on matters, and I allow him the same courtesy. And I think that's why our marriage works so well. When I met Lou at a convention, we were about halfway between where the two of us lived. I lived in Alberta, and he lived in Vancouver at the time. And it's about 1,000 miles apart, and we were about halfway in between. And I did go because it was a cousin, not a nephew, honey. But anyhow, it was my cousin who I had been so, as close as cousins could be since as long as I could remember. And I'd been out to visit him, and he was a real drunk, and still is. But anyhow, I went out to visit him a few times, and I went to some AA meetings while I was there, and I asked the chairperson of one meeting, they were talking about their conference. So I asked if they could send me a brochure on the conference when it was coming up. So anyhow, a couple days before the conference was being held, I received in the mail, and I know this came on the wings of something, because all that was on the front of this folded up flyer was Linda, 4728 Wendelwood, and I was on Rundlewood Road, Calgary. And the postal code was for Eastern Canada. That's like your zip code. And that got to me. So I thought, something's going to happen at this conference. Rich is going to be able to stay sober. I've got to get out and take him to the conference. And of course, it didn't work that way, but I did meet Lou. And I couldn't have run across someone that would make me so happy and that I get along so well with and that I could love so much. And, you know, when I talk about Lou, I feel like from the time I met him to where I'm at today, it's like a butterfly in a cocoon. And he helped me to emerge from that cocoon and to be able to be the person that I am today. And I was sober for 11 years when I met Lou. A couple of years before I met Lou, my first husband had died. He was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis a couple of 18 months before he died. And because the people of Alcoholics Anonymous had taught me so much about compassion and faith and love and unconditional love and caring, I was able to care for him as long as I could. And then when he went to extended care, I went every day and I fed him his dinner after work, after I had been at work. And I stayed with him till he went to bed every night. And the day that the doctor called me and said, "We have to make a decision. He had lapsed into a coma. And he said, we can either put a feeding tube in his stomach and prolong his life, or we can let him go. And I had a lot of prayer around it. We had discussed this, and I knew Dan wanted to just be let go, but it was still a damn hard decision to make. I had to look at why I was doing it. Was I getting even for all those years of the abuse? Or was I doing it because I really cared about him and loved him enough to unselfishly let him go? And I came to the conclusion that I had would let him go. And so they removed the tube, and he died a couple of days later. And that's why, another reason, when I went to this conference in Cranbrook where I met Lou, I was seeking something. I didn't know what it was. I really didn't know what it was. But after Lou talked that night, I bought his tape, and I went up to him, and I gave him a hug and thanked him for what I had received from his talk. And I went home, and I listened to his tape. It was on the steps and working the steps and what you have to do. And I listened to it over and over, and I started doing things that he said to do on that tape. And a couple of months later, that was in August, and in October, I phoned him. And I wrote him a letter, and I said, if you're married or in a relationship, I want this, whoever the person may be, to understand that this is strictly a letter of gratitude, because you have helped me so much in growing in my program because of what I've been listening to on your tape. And he got the letter, and he phoned me back. And, of course, I had added my phone number there just in case. But anyhow, he phoned me, and it started a process of him calling me almost every day, and I'd write letters. And he was getting $800 phone bills a month. This before these good long-distance rate came in. He'd be getting $800 phone bills a month, and I'd be having about couple of bucks on stamps, you know. But anyhow, spring before I met Lou, I have to tell this story because it's a part of how we carry the message to people outside the program, and them just seeing how you work AA in your life makes such a difference. In March of 1990, I was hit head-on by a drunk driver. And I was almost killed in the accident. I had 11 broken bones, and that's where I got the brain injury. I was in a coma for quite some time. And when I was coming out of this coma, the doctor told I had no feeling in my legs, and the doctor told me that I may not walk again. They were going to run some tests, but they were not sure what happened. He said it could be just the compression from when I hit the brake. I put my foot and the brake pedal through the floor of the car. And it broke everything pretty much along this side of my body. And he said it could be swelling there that's causing the numbness. It's pressing thing. He says, or it could be some kind of permanent damage. And, you know, I think it was the first time in my life that I ever prayed to God. And I just said, God, please grant me the serenity to accept whatever comes and to have the courage to deal with it. And I didn't make him any promises that let me walk again and I'll promise I'll stay in AA forever. I didn't do any of that kind of stuff. And I felt so good about it. And anyhow, a few days after I came out of the coma, the nurse came in and she says, there's a young fellow that's been phoning every day checking to see how you're doing. And she told me his name, Conrad, and I said, I don't know anybody by that name. They must have the wrong person. And she said, well, he's very insistent. I guess he got my name off the accident form that the police gives you when you're charged and things like that. And it was the young fellow that had run into me. And I didn't know it at the time, but I told the nurse, well, if it's someone that wants to see me that bad, let him come. Let him come and visit, you know, let him come. I'd like to see who it is. So anyhow, he came in the room, and he had the biggest bouquet of flowers, and he started to cry. He was 22 years old, already on an impaired driving charge before this one. And he came to just check with me and see how I was. He came to visit me in the hospital every day. And when I went home, I still had a cast on this leg and on my arm, and my hands were still in pretty bad shape and everything. And he came to my house, and he'd come and cut my grass and do my vacuuming and just genuinely showed that he was sorry for what he had done. And one day we were sitting there, and I always made him coffee or lunch or dinner, whatever time of day he happened to be there. And he says to me, "Linda, I don't understand how you found it in your heart to forgive me for all the pain and misery that I've put you through." And I said to him, "Well, the program that I belong to teaches me that if I don't forgive, I'm just going to remain a bitter, angry, resentful person. And I can't afford to have that because I know what it'll lead me to." And he says, "Do you mind my asking what the program is?" And I said, "It's Alcoholics Anonymous." And he says, "Can I come to a meeting with you?" He's never had a drink from that day to this. He got married. He got married before the court case came up. It was almost 2 years before we went to court. And he was married, and his wife was expecting their first child. And of course, when we went to the court and they put me on the stand, and my lawyer thought I was doing the wrong thing, but I said, "I want to speak on his behalf. I don't want to see this young man go to jail where he could possibly backslide from where he's at today." And I went to court and I spoke on his behalf. And the judge said he had planned to sentence him to a jail term. And he said, "You understand that I can't allow him to go scot-free." He says, "But since he's a working citizen now and he has a wife, I'm going to sentence him to time to be served on weekends. And the day that their baby's born, if it happens to be a weekend, he'll be allowed out to be there for the birth of his child." It was such a great feeling to know that I had come from a place where I was so hateful and resentful when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsor also told me that if I didn't forgive the man that had raped me, the therapist told me the same thing. If you don't forgive that person, you'll remain hateful and resentful for the rest of your life. And you can't possibly live filled with hatred and resentment and be happy. So I couldn't pray for that man myself, but I prayed to God and asked God to forgive him. And I did that for a long time, just like it talks about in the story Freedom from Bondage in the big book. I prayed that he be given good things, that I don't have to hate this person anymore. And one day I had the feeling of release and peace and serenity inside. And that has stayed with me for that was about 2 years into sobriety, I guess. And that stayed with me for the last 20 years. And my heart is so filled with gratitude for all the things that this program has allowed me to do. In 1990, the winter of 1990, from the 1st December till the end of November, I had the privilege of taking my mom on a cruise from Tahiti to Sydney, Australia. And it was a holiday that my husband and I had planned from the day we were married. That was going to be for our 25th anniversary, and he died just a few days short of our 24th. So I decided that when my 25th rolled around, I was going to go ahead and take this cruise and spend some time in Alaska, in Australia and New Zealand. And I went there and I stayed for 3 months. My mom came home after a week. She spent Christmas and New Year's in Australia with me, and then she flew home. And I toured Australia and New Zealand all by myself. And I met some of the most wonderful people because I was willing and able to step outside my comfort zone and walk up to people and say, "Hi, my name's Linda," and shake their hand. And I met some of the nicest people over there. When I got to New Zealand, I met a pen pal that I had written to since I was 12 years old. that I never ever dreamed in a million years that I would have the opportunity to meet. And fortunately for me, not so fortunate for him, he had broken his leg just before I got there, so he was off work. And his daughter, who was in the process of becoming a lawyer, who was, her name's also Linda, they named her Linda after me, and I was so happy with that, you know. And she was on vacation, so her and her dad took me all over the South Island of New Zealand. And we got down by Queenstown, and we were driving along just before our town, and I saw these people off in the distance on this bridge, and I says to Henry, "What the heck are they doing over there?" And he says, "They're bungee jumping." And I says, "I want to try that." So he thought I was crazy, but anyhow, I says, "There's one thing I have to do first. You have to take me in. I need to go to a drugstore somewhere." And he says, "What for?" And I says, "Well, I've got a upper denture, and I'm not going to risk losing my teeth when I jump off that bridge. There was a river below." So anyhow, he took me in, and I got some of that goop. I don't even know what it's called anymore. It's the only time I ever used it. But anyhow, I put so much of that in, it took me about 4 days to get my teeth out afterwards. But I didn't have to go around gumming it for the rest of my holiday. I was able to continue eating. But anyhow, I did that, and when I was in Australia, I climbed Ayers Rock, and that was something that I had seen a picture of Ayers Rock when I was a young girl in the National Geographic magazine. And I decided that while I was in Australia, I was going to go and I was going to climb this rock. It was plus 46 that day, which in your temperature down here would be around 120-something. It's right in the middle of the desert. I climbed that rock right to the very top. And when I got to the top, I just looked up and I said to my dad, "See, Dad, I made it." Because he used to always say to me when I'd show him this picture and I'd say, "I'm going to climb that rock someday," and he'd always say, "Well, sweetie, I hope that you get the opportunity." And I had the opportunity. Something else that I've done because I'm sober. If I was a drunk still, I wouldn't have had that opportunity. I signed the book at the top, and even most Australians didn't know there was a book there, so I know they've never been right to the top of the rock. Apparently now they've quit people climbing on that rock because the Aboriginals have claimed it back as a sacred grounds, that land that belongs to them. After I came down, it's not bad going up because, I mean, it's a shale rock. It's bad enough, don't get me wrong. It's bad enough going up. But when you get to the top and you look down, and these buses down there are kind of looking like matchbox toys, and you're standing up there thinking, now, if I slip, that's it. There's not a bush, there's not a tree, there's not a ledge, there's absolutely nothing to grab onto. If you lose your footing, that's it. When I got back down, they took me around to the side of the Ayers Rock, where all the plaques are in memory of people that had either had heart attacks or had fallen from that rock. And I asked why they didn't show me that first in the... The tour guide told me, she says, "We know if we'd showed you that first, we knew you had talked about what your dream to climb this rock, and we knew that if we showed you that there was a possibility, you wouldn't follow through on one of your dreams." And I'm grateful in hindsight that they didn't tell me, because it was another of my dreams that has come true in sobriety. And in 1996, I turned 50 years old, and Lou threw the biggest surprise birthday party for me. I mean, you could have blown me away with a feather, the surprise. I was as surprised as I was when I saw Nancy Lee and Buddy walk through these doors yesterday. But anyhow, and my mom wrote me a letter on my 50th birthday, and it was a letter from the time that I was born to where I was at the age of 50 years. And it's my most prized possession today. I keep it in the safe deposit box. I don't want to risk anything ever happening to it. And she wrote in there about my struggles with being raped, with the physical and mental abuse that I went through, with the rejection of my children, and with all the other things that I've been able to rise above in Alcoholics Anonymous. and she wanted to say thank you to Alcoholics Anonymous for what they've done for me. And the reason that that letter is my most prized possession today is because my mom went home, and 2 months later she dropped dead with a massive heart attack. It's really hard to do. It's difficult to know that you have to go on the rest of your life with not seeing those people again, like my father, my husband, my mother. But I know I will see them again one day. And I know that they're in my heart. And that's the place that's most important to me. About 2.5 years ago, I went to see my doctor about some problems I was having, and he told me that I had cancer, and I was floored at first. I had absolutely no idea, you know, that that's what was wrong. And fortunately for me, you know, the surgery and treatment, I've been cancer-free for 2.5 years, and I know it's going to continue that way. But I also know that if it doesn't, that's God's will. It's his plan for me. When I'm done here on earth, I'll be done. And there's not a thing that I can do about it. So I don't dwell on that kind of a thing anymore, because of this happening, it gave me a new outlook on every day that I live. I realize how short life can be, and that we don't know how long we're going to be here. I don't want to die having amends that I didn't make, or people that didn't like me and that I had never talked to find out the reason why. And there are a lot of people that don't like me, and that's okay. There's a lot of people I don't like too. And if they ask me, I'll tell them the reason why, because I know that I could do that today. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a people pleaser. I did everything that everybody wanted me to do. I didn't do anything that these steps teach me that I can do on my own if I work them in my daily living. You know, one of the sayings that I hear in AA is this business that the door swings both ways. You know, maybe it does. But boy, I'm going to tell you, we've had more friends that have swung out that door and have not made it back. They've either died or they're still out there drinking, and there's a good possibility they will die. So if there's anybody new in here today, you know, there's absolutely no reason that you ever have to take another drink if you work this program, if you work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and accept a loving God in your life. Because, you know, without God in my life today, I would be nothing. I'd be nothing. And any time that I'm having problems in my life, I go back to step 3, and I look at, I know I made that decision, and I know I only made the decision that I would accept God, that I'd turn my will and my life over to his care every day for the rest of my life. But when I get up in the morning, I turn my will over for that day, because that decision was made 22 years ago. And it's a decision that I've followed through with every day in the last 22 years. I've never gotten to a point so low where I'd turn my back on God again. I realized when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that I never turned my life, my God never turned his back on me. I turned my back on him. If I had asked for help back then, I would have received it. But I also know today that my life has gone in exactly the pattern that God intended it to be. And that it's just the way it is. You know, when I go to my home group every week, I go early. Lou and I usually do the coffee because we love doing coffee, and if newcomers are there and want to do it, they do it, and we meet them there, you know, a half hour later to visit. I always go to my home group at least an hour early. We stand and I hug and greet every single person that comes through the door, because that's what was done to me. And that was what gave me the feeling of being a useful person when after I arrived here. And a few years ago, I started looking at the letters in that word hugs, you know. And my whole program's in those letters. You know, the H is for the hope that I felt when I first got here. And then I was told that I had to be honest or I'd go nowhere. And then through being honest, I began to work the steps, and I gained humility. And then the U is for unconditional love and unity. And the G is for the God, God's grace, growth, gratitude. And the S is for the first when I came in, my sponsor, the sponsorship, and the serenity and my sobriety. So, you know, when I look at those words and at the letters in that word, and I stop and think, how could I not hug people when they come through this door? I want them to have what I got. You know, some of us get it and some don't. There's still a lot of people. We see people that are dying every day because they just couldn't get a grasp of this program. I'm grateful that I'm one of the ones that is able to stand up here today and say that I have sobriety, I have serenity, and I have Lou in my life. Oh, the other G I was trying to think about is for golf. You know, I never golfed until I've done so many things in sobriety, it's unbelievable. I never golfed till 4 years ago. Lou loved to golf, but he would never golf from when I met him until 4 years ago. That first almost 7 years, when he had a day off work, he would always spend the day with me. He never went golfing with his buddies or anything. He says, we're married, and I want to spend my day off with you. So anyhow, at Christmas 4 years ago, I said, okay, go. I didn't say it quite like that, but that's how I meant it to be. go buy me a set of golf clubs for Christmas. That can be my Christmas gift. So anyhow, he went out and I says, and don't spend too much money because if I don't like the game, it'll be a total loss, you know, on these golf clubs. So anyhow, he went and he bought me these golf clubs and some golf lessons. And I took the golf lessons and now he has to come to the golf course to find me. Actually, we golf together almost every single day. And in the area of Canada that we live in, we may get a little skiff of snow once over the winter. About every 4 years we get a storm. But other than that, we have really, really nice weather year-round. And we golf almost every day. And we enjoy golfing together. I started golf on a ladies' league, and it lasted 2 years. And I thought, you know, I don't need this kind of torture and resentment in my life. So anyhow, I got away from the ladies' league, and they pair me and Lou up with any people that are new people that are coming to the course. If it's brand new golfers, they say, oh, we'll send you out with Lou and Linda because they're here to enjoy the game. They're not here to, you know, compete or beat the other guy or whatever. We enjoy the game. We have fun at it, and I'm actually getting pretty good at it, and I'm quite happy about that. And then 2 years ago, we were at a jazz festival, these women came into the room and they were tap dancing. So anyhow, I asked after I went over to them and I says, how can I get involved in this? I'd like to find out a little bit more about it. And they said, well, we'll send our instructor over. So Burl came over and she talked to me and she says, I'll give you a call in September when we start the beginner's classes. So anyhow, she phoned me in September and I started tap dancing 2 years ago. And I'm pretty darn good at that, too. And the little group that I tap dance with are called the Happy Tappers. and we go around to extended care hospitals and old folks' homes and things like that, and we just do entertainment for free. And the people are so appreciative of what we do. Anyhow... I'm probably running over my time here. I should likely just get this wound up. But I just want once again to say, you know, thank you to everybody here, for the people that have come into the room this morning to listen, and what a privilege it is for me to share my experience, strength, and hope with all of you. And just remember, if you're new, you know, you're here now. Stay. don't get go back out because we don't want to lose anybody else. Thanks for my sobriety.